COVID shined a light on the issues that the early education field had already been struggling with for years. Going back to normal is simply not good enough. Our teachers deserve more. If you're ready to be bold, address systemic inequity, and elevate the workforce, we invite you to join us March 15th through 17th for Interact Now, a class summit. Choose from 30 sessions over 3 days and network with leading experts, share your work, and meet colleagues across the world. Visit teachstone.com/interact to learn more and register.
Hello and welcome back to Impacting the Classroom. In each episode, you'll hear from educators, policymakers, and researchers who are making an impact in education. Today's topic is about funding, and we have some real experts that we're going to hear from, and we're excited about the conversation today. I'm Dr. Darlene Estes Del Rey.
And I'm Marnetta Larimer. Today, I'm joined by two esteemed guests who will share federal policy updates and what that means for funding early childhood education. My first guest is Anne Hedgepeth. Anne Hedgepeth is a Child Care Aware of America's Deputy Chief of Policy. Welcome, Anne. And I'm also excited to be joined by Tiffany Lee, who serves as the prenatal to 3 policy advisor for City of Seattle Department of Education and Early Learning. Welcome, Tiffany.
Thank you.
So investing in early childhood means funding programs and innovative strategies for children, and numerous studies have demonstrated that children with access to quality early learning are more prepared for kindergarten. And can you summarize what's happening at the federal level that may lead to more funding for early childhood programs?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because it is a big moment for childcare and early learning when it comes to policy, and particularly the opportunity that's ahead of us for increased investment in childcare and early learning. I think folks know this, but it's worth saying that the model right now isn't working, and there is just not enough investment in childcare and early learning, and that gets passed through to parents. They're paying a price that's way too high or out of reach. It gets passed through to educators who see suppressed wages and who, you know, ultimately continue the incredible job of caring for children despite some of the really challenging elements of the career path related to compensation. And we need to change that, right? We need to fix that. And ultimately, we have a chance to do that. And in some ways, it's really exciting to say that Congress and the White House have identified investing in childcare and early learning as a priority. As a result of the pandemic, relief funding is flowing to childcare and early learning, over $50 billion over the past 18 months, and states are working to get that out the door, but that is not a long-term solution. And so we saw in the spring of 2021 that President Biden proposed a longer-term investment in childcare, and Congress has drafted a bill called the Build Back Better Act that would do just that. It would put for 6 years over $400 billion in childcare and preschool, and really make a difference in terms of bringing the price of childcare down for families. We'd see a majority of families be eligible for subsidy, or maybe even have no copay when it comes to affording childcare. And we'd see states really change the way they pay childcare programs and providers, making sure there were living wages for our educators, and making sure that the money needed to build high quality programs flows into our childcare system. So it's really exciting. And I think it's totally worth us talking about how to get it done, because this is how we would transform and will transform childcare in the coming years.
So thinking about some of that funding, when and how can providers access this money?
Great question. So right now, and you know, like I said, this isn't the long-term solution, but it's also really important given the moment we're in. States are distributing funding that they received from the 3 different COVID relief packages over the course of 2020 and 2021. Those are known as the CARES Act, CIRSA or CIRSA, a long acronym that, you know, at the end of the day, hardly matters, and the American Rescue Plan Act, which all three taken together are putting a lot of money into the childcare system. And states are right now standing up stabilization grants, and those are available to programs and providers, and they can be used for a whole host of things. There are many states, most states, who have applications up right now, and a few stragglers who we expect to have up in the next few weeks, so in early 2022. And I think it's really important for programs and providers to know that that money is available. And in most states, their applications are open, or they've had one round of grants and may have a second round coming, but it is worth reaching out to some of those system leaders who can be really helpful. Your state lead agency, check out their website. Your child care resource and referral agency, in many states, they're helping distribute the funds and provide technical assistance. And that money is about, you know, paying your mortgage, rent, dealing with paying your staff, increasing compensation, recruitment bonuses, paying yourself if you haven't been for years. This is all about stabilizing the childcare system, and that those resources are available right now.
Thank you so much.
Tiffany, I know you're a fierce advocate for family childcare programs. Tell me how they fit into that equation and how they can access the funding.
Absolutely. As Anne had mentioned, these state lead agencies are dispersing or making available these grants, the stabilization grants. And just like their center counterparts, family childcare providers can connect with their local childcare aware organizations or even state licensors. I think that part of the money that was given to states is sort of allocated for technical assistance and for marketing and outreach, which I thought was a really great and exciting thing. It's a recognition that you can't just make it available. Access is about translation of materials because so many of our providers serve emerging English learners. And I think for family childcare, there's this sense that people in this field are doing it because they have good hearts and they love children. And I think that that's true. But when we talk about money and childcare, it's almost as if we expect childcare providers to not make a profit. Like it's evil. Like they're not in it for the money. Well, they should be able to pay their mortgage or their rent, or they should be able to have a car that doesn't break down all the time. So I always think it's interesting when we talk about the financing of childcare, and you have so many great points, and I'm also very hopeful. This is a very exciting time. And I think it's a silver lining in this really profoundly heartbreaking scenario and circumstance of COVID-19 is the world stopped. And I feel like early childhood and childcare providers in particular emerged as leaders and essential. We really saw the field as being essential, not just to child development, which absolutely it is, but to the economy. So we're sort of like garnering support from corners of the world that we didn't know that we would have support from. So,
yeah. I love that you mentioned that the profit piece. I think a lot of times people don't understand how much it costs to run a childcare facility. So making a profit is hard, right? It'd be great as a goal, but I mean, with regulations and, you know, paying the insurance for the transportation and like just all of the costs in that, there's never enough money to support, you know, running a facility. And so I do think a lot of times we don't think about the cost of running that specific type of business. Right? Educating your teachers, right? They have to have so many clock hours, like just all of the different things and the amount of money, you know, that it costs to do that.
Oh, I love what you're saying. And I think now, especially with everyone being challenged with a workforce sort of like shortage, it's more important than ever that we're paying these educators to keep them, to retain them, and even to attract people. If you have a choice between working at Starbucks or Target or being, you know, following your heart and your calling in life, it shouldn't be the difference between health insurance and not health insurance, or like being able to pay, you know, for a place to live or not being able to pay for a place to live. Thank you, Marnetta. I agree.
And I also think that one of the things that you're each identifying is that, you know, this isn't about sort of a race to the bottom and who can create the cheapest childcare, that this is about a recognition of what it takes to build and invest in high quality childcare and early learning that is developmentally appropriate, where educators can invest in themselves and their professional development. And it is hard to say this, but like, that does take money, right? That is about our priorities, in our communities and as a country, and building a partnership where the appropriate amounts of resources come from families and from our, you know, public investment as a whole and from us all as a part of investing in the future. We're on the cusp of getting so much closer to a better formula, I guess, for lack of a better word, because right now that it doesn't add up, and it doesn't add up for so many programs who are really struggling to figure out how to make it work, and for so many families who get priced out and for whom access is not real, because they can't afford it, or they can't afford the kind of childcare that they're looking for, the high quality childcare they're looking for. And I think those dynamics are all very caught up in also, you know, just the math, right? The math that so many program directors, owners, and educators are dealing with every day.
I appreciate that, Anne. And I think with the family childcare providers, I think that, you know, the pandemic has also revealed just how amazing they are as essential workers, even beyond the fact that they showed up and stayed the course. But I think it also revealed to folks how flexible they are and how they meet families where they need them in the outside the normal hours. Like they constantly do that, whether, you know, it's different days of the week and different times of the day. And I think that's kind of setting up a different model for folks to think about, like, what do families really need? But what's the price of that? And what's the quality? It's all kind of wrapped around that. But Tiffany, I'm also curious just to, in the space of the family childcare providers, like, what are you hearing about how they want to use the money and maybe what they're hoping for, or also like what you're hoping that they might think about, you know, maybe one of a two pronger there, like, what do you hear there? You know, maybe they're wanting to use the money for, and then maybe what you're hoping they might also consider.
Well, that's a great question. I've heard a range of things. As you'd mentioned, as Anne had mentioned, actually, states sort of vary where they, in terms of where they are in dispensing these funds. I've heard everything from, I've been putting off fixing the toilet that, you know, is leaking and is causing my water bill to be higher than it really should, all the way to, I'm putting this away because this might happen again, you know, and there might be a period where children can't be in care and I'm not going to have an income. And so I'm hearing everything and between those. A lot of people are talking about catching up, things that they had put off, and not even luxuries. They just feel like very practical expenses right now. And I think it's a manifestation, again, of our really flawed financing system of childcare. I hope that they would use it on things and not feel like they're being selfish. Because again, I really feel, based on the family childcare providers I know, that there's this like proclivity to selflessness, as if that's a good thing. And then at the same time, so that's our sort of unspoken expectation. But at the same time, we facilitate trainings about self-care. And it's just really ironic and unfortunate. Not sort of putting money aside, I'd like for all of us to mobilize around this momentum that we've built around how essential and necessary family childcare is, especially to your point, Darlene, about non-traditional hours. I think about our shift and pivot to the gig economy and how that is sort of challenging the way we think about the 9-to-5, and we'll need care for that. Also, thinking about single parents, single fathers, single mothers, and how in order for them to sort of continue to progress in their career, they really need reliable and trustworthy childcare, and have found it in family childcare providers, but it should be compensated fairly. So I sort of answered it.
I love that. I think that you've touched on many of those things. And I don't know if you wanted to add to that. Otherwise, I think Marnetta has an
answer. I do. I'm inviting to talk. Like, I'm just like, there's so many things that Tiffany said mm-hmm. that I just want to follow up on. I think, across states, some states, family child care isn't really legitimized, right? Like, so my question would be, when we're talking about funding and the value of family child care, right? How do we ensure that family child care providers who are not licensed, right, but still provide quality services have access to what they need as well, right? Because here in the state of Louisiana, we don't license family child care, mm-hmm. right? They can be registered, but they still don't have access to all of the things legally, right? The funding, they don't have access to the pools of money that other facilities have access to. So how do we support them?
I think typically they don't. Licensed, exempt, or registered family child care providers, they don't typically have access to these. But correct me if I'm wrong, Anne. I think that these ARPA funds are available to family, friends, and neighbor care and family child care providers.
Yeah. So what we're seeing, one of the things I really want to name, and I'm so glad you brought this up, is that states have dramatically different systems across the country. And we use terms like licensed and registered and regulated, license exempt. They mean different things in different places. And the work that child care programs, family child care, in some cases faith-based child care programs are a part of all of those various pools. The work that they do to be high quality is often not a part of some of the things that maybe they do to be recognized in the state right now, because those aren't very well aligned. And we do also allow many of the programs who are registered, regulated, license exempt to participate in things like the subsidy system, right? And that's because there is a mishmash across the country in terms of requirements. Ultimately, relief funds have generally been made available to programs that, one, are part of the subsidy system. And in many states, that means that they are licensed, registered, regulated, something in that whole category. And other states have been using some of the funds, which they're allowed to from certain pools of it, to reach even those that aren't part of the subsidy system through grants or other forms of support. So it is possible, and I think this is an important message to folks, is it is possible that there is some support out there for you. And one of the things we learned in the pandemic is that so many states don't have great ways to reach every single childcare educator or program or provider. And they may be seeking to build pathways for many of those to become into a more recognized system to support them in their quality efforts to do work that would make a difference in their communities. And we don't have a great way to operationalize that. And that has to change. And some states have really changed that over the course of the pandemic. They've had things like their child care resource and referral agency have like called every single program and provider in the state that they can find to update information and get their email address. I know in several states where CCR&R staff is going door to door to programs and providers carrying tablets to help them to apply for any of the grants that are available. There are some really cool things happening. Childcare of Kansas has navigators to help childcare programs and providers who maybe also need to maybe bring some of their financial information up to date in order to apply. Like, if that's part of it, then let's get it done. But ultimately, I think we also have to talk about moving towards a future where we don't have all these different categories, where we actually figure out how to build appropriate standards for different types of settings. And they wouldn't be the same, right? But they would exist so that we don't have people who are in or out, and we figure out how to create pathways for them to be a part of this important investment that's coming. And the Build Back Better Act does that, but it's hard work, and it will be hard work. work, and it requires states to build licensing standards in conjunction with the programs and providers in different settings, and then create a pathway for all of them and the money they need to do it. But like, that is hard work. And that's what we all have to gear up for if that's on the horizon. And it's going to be a project. And so the right now isn't working great, but there are some relief funds available, and the future could get better, but we're going to have to figure out how to make that happen.
Wonderful. That was a great response. What are some themes emerging from state requirements on how they plan to strategically use the funds, right? So as we think about that, Anne, I'll start with you. Equity, you know, support workforce, recovery efforts. Talk to me some about that.
Yeah, it's so interesting to think too about it. We've been talking mostly about stabilization grants in this conversation, but states got money that they can also use to bring down or eliminate copays for families. And we have a number of states who have done that. For example, Georgia has just bumped their eligibility up to the maximum allowed under current law. And that means something like 100,000 more children will be able to be a part of the subsidy system in that state using relief funds. And that's a game changer for families, and really important when we talk about what difference relief funds can make. We've seen a number of states build in bonuses for educators, and programs are getting additional funding if they increase compensation. And I think that's going to be really critical when we look at recruitment and retention in the field over the next few months and years for that matter. So those are all, I think, really interesting places to start to poke and think about, like, okay, great, we've done this good thing. How can we keep it going, right? And like, what kind of a difference would this make in terms of families and our educators, both of whom are driving our economy?
Tiffany, did you want to add anything to that question?
Well, it made me think about, because we're sort of like weaving through two types of funding. One is, I think, around appropriate compensation or fair compensation. So we're long-term. And then the other one is these sort of like short-term bursts of grants. And I think about, that just makes me think about how we're asking families to pay for education, sort of like in the K-12 system, if there weren't a public investment in K-12, everyone would be paying, you know, like $12,000 a year for their children to be in school. And that's a screaming deal, because especially now, having had children at home and, you know, virtual school, and they just don't pay teachers enough. I think we can all agree with that. And so it just makes me think about, is it a matter when we're talking, when we're having this national conversation, is it a matter of like a paradigm shift, helping people see not the value, because I feel like the value, there's a consensus that it is valuable, but also that it's worth a public investment in the way that K-12 system has a public investment. And again, that's, you know, the Build Back Better. It's very exciting that this could be coming, but I wonder what role we have in sort of messaging that, and what role we have in normalizing care as part of like this continuum of education. And then you get, it's really tricky, because then you have like purists that are like, it's not education, it's, you know, it's different, which I think we mean the same thing. There's like an education or a human development approach. They're sort of like two. Is it human services or is it education? And it's like, it's both.
Yeah, exactly. It's intertwined.
You know, it's interesting too. I feel like something that should be named here as well, connected to what you're saying to me, is sort of like, who are we talking about too? Because there's a real, I think, conversation about equity to be had there as well. It is important to talk about these things on the macro level as, you know, the investment and the comparison to K-12, but also let's be real about who's doing the work right now and being, in many ways, marginalized, taken advantage of, and not in a way that is like, anyone is a victim, but is a result of generations of our approach to how women, and in particular women of color who are caregivers, are treated in our society. And I do think that, you know, that's hard to grapple with. And as someone who does government relations work, I know it's not the rallying cry for every politician I talk to, but it's really important as a place of grounding. And then when we talk about how money flows, because money is ultimately how we get some stuff done, and it's how we express our priorities as a country in a lot of ways, as depressing as that is. Thank you, capitalism. You know, we then also have to grapple with where is the money going? And I do want to mention, and I forgot to say this earlier when we were talking about, you know, where really funding and tackling equity issues, is measuring where our money goes and knowing where it goes also, I think, is a helpful part of the discussion, so that when we talk about the resourcing of the sector of women, when we talk about resourcing our youngest children and investing in them, we are clear that we're doing it, and we're doing it well in an equitable way. And we have seen some states, and in particular, when they have an intermediary helping them distribute stabilization grants, who are keeping track, right? They know, and they are in some cases, and this is like gold star, but it shouldn't have to be something you get an award for, is they're transparent about it, right? They're like, these are the programs, these are the providers, these are the settings, these are the areas in the state, these are the owners of the programs and their, you know, race and gender makeup. Like, we should be talking about that, because when we miss on those elements and we're not able to fill in those gaps, we perpetuate some of the inequities with even that exist within the childcare system, much less outside in relation to it. So I know that was a little bit of a mishmash, but my brain was sort of thinking through, you know, yeah, let's talk about this as a public good, but also, you know, part of, I think, our country's hesitation is the who, and like, what, who is a part of childcare right now, and how hard that is for us to grapple with resourcing it well.
That was a beautiful mishmash, though, right? Absolutely beautiful mishmash. I love that you mentioned some forces outside of the education setting that really impact what happens here. What are some other things that would be important for us to address outside of education to ensure that there's going to be an equal playing field for the children?
Well, you know, I feel like this came up earlier when we were talking about, I think when we have conversations about childcare, it can happen in a vacuum of the experience and the lives that both the children and families and childcare programs and providers, educators, are having. And for me, what I mean is, we have to also consider some of the food insecurity that our children and families and educators are facing. We have to consider some of the housing insecurity that children, families, and educators are facing. We can solve some things about childcare, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have solved the realities of poverty and of income insecurity for everyone who's engaged in that system. And that means the partnerships and the work that we do. I do it on a policy level and coalition building. So many of you all do it on a community level when you're thinking about who are you working with and collaborating with. But, you know, those things come along with making childcare available and accessible and affordable. We have to do those other pieces too. So I think that's one part of the puzzle when I think about what we're facing.
Tiffany, do you have any thoughts on that question?
Yeah. Thank you, Anne. That was a good place to start, for sure. And just to build on your point, I think that there's an opportunity to look at it holistically and to look at not just the child, but the whole family. And it sort of reminds me of conversations that we've had in K-12 around these performance metrics, the standardized assessments, and sort of like tying teacher compensation or quality to the outcome of those measures, and how things way outside of the control of the educator or the school grossly affect the child's performance. So you can be an engaging master teacher and be working miracles in the classroom, but if the child is returning to a home that is challenged by material poverty, food insecurity, housing insecurity. That's something that even the best instruction, I don't think can overcome. And so that's just sort of what that made me think about, is sort of like, we think about childcare as being something that can realize or be a vehicle for realizing the advancement of racial equity, or at least I do. And there are all these other moving parts. And sometimes I just sit back and wonder, like, maybe instead of focusing on that alone, how can we pull in our sisters and brothers that are working sort of like in housing and in human services and really support the whole family? So I appreciate that.
Tiffany, I love that. You know, we always know this catchphrase in early childhood that it takes a village to raise a child, but I think we've gotten away from our village. Like, we have silos within our village, but like that, hearing you talk made me think about bringing all the pieces of our villages together so that we're working for the good of the whole community. So all families, all children, and the whole community, I think, is an opportunity, but the new model, right? We've got a lot of opportunity with Build Back Better. So appreciate you bringing that up. I wanted just to thank you both for just joining this conversation today. I've enjoyed just hearing about what's possible yet, keeping our eyes on Build Back Better, and thinking about a new model and what we can do, and also messaging that, yes, this is a lot of funding coming to the way of early childhood, but it needs to be long-term. I heard that loud and clear, because it's important for us to message to the greater public that, because there could be a misunderstanding, right? To say like, well, you got the money and now that's one and done, but really to understand that it's been a long time coming and there's more yet to be done, and it needs to be sustainable and equitable, and that equal doses of funding is not equitable. So to really get that message out there too, that just, you know, passing out equal, you know, buckets or bundles is not the way there either. So I'm encouraged and just appreciate your thought, just your thoughts around these issues today. And I know that our listeners will too. We're going to post the transcription and the related resources on our site at teachstone.com/impacting. And we will see you next episode, when we will have an exciting and engaging conversation around universal pre-K and what that could mean for families, educators, and communities.
And remember, behind great leading and teaching are powerful interactions. Let's build that culture together.